Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 16th of February 2014. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Web Cowgirl, Paul in London, and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about What the Women Did, which is just closed at the Southwark Playhouse. This is a collection of three short plays, written around the time of the First World War and reflecting on what life was like in the First World War for the women more than anything else. We have Luck of War, which is about a wife who has recently remarried after her husband was declared dead, and he has not written to her, and so everyone assumes she's dead, and suddenly he comes in through the door. Well, they find out that he's not quite as dead as they thought he was. That's Luck of War, written by Gwen John. Then we have Handmaidens of Death. It says by Herbert Tremaine, although that's a pseudonym for Maud Duchar, I believe. And that's about a group of canary girls who are munitions workers whose skin was turned yellow by their work, who decide to put messages to the Germans in the shells that they're making. And in a rather dark scene, a literally dark scene where you can't see anything, they are visited by a group of strangely talking people who they think are Belgians. I found that one quite effective, really. And possibly the best one, written by J.M. Barrie, is The Old Woman Shows Her Medals, which focuses on a group of charwomen who talk about their children being in the war, and one of them has pulled the name from a paper, and he turns up on her doorstep, and they begin a relationship. Now, this is a fringe show, but we do have a couple of names in it. We have Susan Wooldridge, who plays the old woman in Old Lady Shows Her Medals, and we also have Matthew Cottmore. He's in two small parts in the first and third play. I found these rather interesting to see. I think some of the acting was a little bit, well, shall we say, broad. I think that because they've got a fairly large cast of other actors, they sometimes have to play older than they are, and it doesn't that sort of thing doesn't quite work. But certainly Simon Darwin, who plays the returning husband and the person who Mrs. Dowie adopts in Old Lady Shows Her Medals, he is rather impressive in both the things he does. I found this an entertaining piece to see. I mean, obviously it's the First World War centenary, so we're going to get an awful lot of plays looking back at the First World War, and these are really rather good discoveries, I thought, or rediscoveries, to see really what people were thinking at the time. They are all written during the war, 1917, 1918, and it's an interesting perspective on it because none of them are particularly triumphalist or particularly sort of down on everything. I mean, death is a very real thing in all these plays, and the possibility of death is always there, but they're not quite as miserable as you might think they are, and nor are they sort of that kind of extreme jingoism. So I found it, in the end, a fascinating evening. I think some of the acting is a little bit variable, but altogether I thought it was very well worth seeing. What did you think about it, Gareth?
Yes, I agree, and I think it's the combination of the three plays that makes the evening, to be honest. I think if you took each of the three plays separately, I don't think you'd have the same feeling as seeing the three together. Because it does do what it says in the overall title that they've chosen, really, What the Women Did. It tells you what the women did back here during the First World War, which is a completely different perspective on what we're normally used to seeing on the First World War. I actually wasn't planning to go, and in some perverse course of events, I sent a short list of plays to my friends in Iceland who were visiting, asking them what would they like to go and see, and just kind of threw this in as a bit of a ringer. And they chose it and invited a 93-year-old British lady war veteran, Second World War veteran, to join us. So it was a really perverse course of events that led to me going. I was really, really glad I went. My view of the plays is a bit different from yours in terms of what I enjoyed most. The first play, The Luck of War, with the husband missing in action, was for me the best, because I thought it had a lot of depth. And I thought there were particularly good performances from Victoria G and Simon Darwin. Simon Darwin being the man who comes back, as it were, and Victoria G, his wife. And then I also enjoyed the third play, The Old Lady Shows Her Medals, which was J.M. Barrie, as of Peter Pan, who wrote that, next. I thought it was pushed a little bit too far to comedy in a way, but I enjoyed that play very much, you know, the sort of, you know, the creation of the fantasy sun, as it were, which I thought was a fascinating idea, and it did surprise you a bit. The Handmaidens of Death was, I didn't really know much about the munitions factories and the you know, the girls who are risking their lives, really, and they call them canary girls because the handling of the munitions sometimes turned their faces yellow. But I didn't think the play went anywhere in the same way, but I thought it was well done, and I quite liked the sort of scene in darkness that you mentioned earlier on, really. But as I said, it's the combination of the three plays together that makes it a rewarding evening. And by Frin standards, I mean, they've gone to a lot of trouble with the set. Alex Marcus created a really big set by Frin standards. There's some really nice costumes by Emily Stewart. And you've got a cast of 14 plus two children, you know, which for the Fringe is really quite something. They also kind of link them together quite nicely with some sort of business in between and some singing at the beginning, where they're singing kind of wartime songs, really. So I thought it was a really nice combination, very timely, very worthwhile project. And I think it's finished. But if it turns up again during this anniversary or indeed later, I'd certainly recommend it.
We're now going to talk about 12 Angry Men, which has been on in the West End for a few months now. It stars Martin Shaw, Jeff Fahey, Nick Moran and Robert Vaughan. It's probably most famous for the film adaptation, which was an adaptation of by Sidney Lumet, and that in turn was an adaptation of when it was a TV play in America. The film adaptation starred Henry Fonda, amongst others. This production, directed by Christopher Hayden, has a slight echo of a production done in Edinburgh, I think, by it's called the Comedians Theatre Company or something, because you've got Owen O'Neill, who appeared in that production, in this, and I'm not sure how much they're connected. Gareth, what did you think about this, and how well did it stand up?
The two aren't connected, except in that Owen O'Neill was in the Edinburgh production. I did see the Edinburgh production. It was the first production by this Comedians Company that went on to do One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and this last year they did The Shawshank Redemption. And it's a very successful venture, but that's a very different production, although very well acted by people you know better as stand-up comedians. This is an independent production that Bill Kenwright's put together, I suspect as a showcase for Martin Shaw, his friend. And I think it's just doing a four-month run in the West End. It's entering its last month now. I think it holds up remarkably well. I mean, I think, you know, it is, and as you say, it's an old war horse, really. I mean, before it was a film, in 57, it was actually a TV play, a live TV play in the US in 1954. It was first put on stage here quite a long time ago in the mid-60s. And there was quite a famous production directed by Harold Pinter back in the mid-90s. And then again in 2003, we had this Edinburgh Fringe production, which I don't think actually made it to London. Even though it's an old war horse, it really does still, you know, it's still a great morality play. I mean, everybody probably knows what the story is. You know, the story is a jury, it's just in a jury room, and they're about to vote unanimously on a guilty verdict when one of the jurors votes not guilty, so that there is a debate. And then what happens for the next 2 hours is that gradually people change their positions and tempers raise, they go over the evidence. I think what makes this particular production very, very good is just the performances. Martin Shaw is good, and indeed Robert Vaughan, it's great to see him on stage. But the performance for me of this play is Jeff Fahey, who is an American actor who I don't think has been on stage here in the UK for about almost 30 years. I saw him, a much younger Jeff Fahey, in the Hampstead Theatre in a play called Orphans with Albert Finney, which I think transferred into the West End. And he's just so good and just gives this wonderful, riveting, edgy, passionate performance that right at the end of the play actually just grabs you by the throat, really. You know, other great performances as well. I really like Nick Moran, who plays the kind of jokey character, Miles Richardson, who's the sort of the very down-to-earth guy. And Owen O'Neill is good, you know, reprising the same role as he did in the Edinburgh production. So it's just incredibly well performed, simply staged. They've just, you know, round a jury table, which imperceptibly moves. I didn't even realize for quite a while that it was moving, so that you kind of see the jury from different perspectives. But very simple stage by Christopher Hayden, who I think runs the Gate Theatre in London, and a very clever design by Michael Pavelka. So I think it's high quality West End fare, and I think it is worth reviving. I think it is, I mean, it's in many ways a safe thing to go to, but I took 4 out-of-town friends who thoroughly enjoyed it, you know, and it was a really good choice, because it was meaty enough but not too heavy, as it were, for people who don't go to theatre quite so often as I do. So a month, I think, left to go, and I'd certainly recommend seeing it in the last in its last month.
Yeah, I certainly enjoyed this. I mean, it is as you say, it is a bit of an old war horse, but it is such a compelling story, and it's one of those films when I do tend to watch it whenever it's on, because it is something you just want to keep watching. It is that compelling. This is, as you say, a very well done piece. Jeff Fahey, who has that kind of heavy lifting of the man who is angry, and we slowly uncover why he's angry. I wasn't quite so impressed by Robert Vaughn, but I thought that they were sort of giving him a helping hand. It was early in the production when I saw it several months ago, and I think that he's probably got used to the rigours of it, but I think he was taking it slightly gently on the night I saw it. So he wasn't quite there, and he did seem to think that they were letting him sit down an awful lot. But I don't think I can really criticise his performance, because it's a great treat to see him in there. And it's a nice play to see, and I'm glad I saw it, and I'm glad we get a chance to talk about it as well, because it is it's also a fascinating piece of history above anything else. That kind of capturing that time in America, which they really do quite well.
I had a conversation with one of my companions who jokingly said he'd like to see an all-female version where it starts with everybody saying not guilty except one person chirps up guilty. And then when I was looking up on the play afterwards, I discovered that there wasn't an all-female version, but it's often done now by mixed cast. So you've got a jury that's both mixed men and women, which of course at that time they didn't have. But if you look at the history, it wasn't that juries had to be all male at that period of time. It was just that women could appear, but men had to appear on a jury. And women opted out of juries because they didn't particularly want to do it a lot of the time, I gather. So there have been subsequently versions called 12 Angry Jurors, which have had different casting, but the same story, which I thought was a really interesting, thing.
A lot of the parts could easily be done by women in the jury. I mean, even the Martin Shaw role could be done as a woman, and indeed the Jeff Fahey role. There's certainly there are, you know, there are few which are very male, but not all of them. And you know, there's a sense of disappointment in sort of the Jeff Fahey juror. His disappointment, it could easily be done by a woman, so it would be quite interesting to see something like that. Although it also would be quite interesting to see, you know, not necessarily an all female role, but a response to this play in some ways, where you have 12 women on stage, because that's always fun to see.
Yeah, I really would quite like to see some of the characters change to women and see how the play changes and unfolds. It'll be a really interesting thing for someone to do. I'm not so sure about the all-female version, but still.
We're now going to talk about In Skagway by Katie Ardiff, which is on at the Arcola Theatre in their smaller space. Web Cowgirl, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, this play was originally done as a radio production, which I think is fairly important in trying to understand the way that it's written. And also, it's notable that the playwright was a carer for her mother when she had a stroke. This rather smoothly leads into the subject of the play. There is a cabin in Skagway, Alaska, during the just about to be the tail end of the gold rush, in which there are three women. Frankie, a music hall star / actress who's from Ireland, who's fallen on bad times. More about that in a minute. May, Frankie's quasi-servant / carer / best friend, but I think best described as flunky. And May's daughter, T-Belle, who thinks that her father's a soldier. What's happened is that Frankie has apparently suffered a stroke and is now sitting mostly paralyzed in this wretched little cabin and being taken care of by May, who is convinced that Frankie is going to be better just any old minute. We don't know exactly why they have come to Skagway in the first place, but May gives us quite a description of Frankie's previous career as an actress who was best known for playing the queen in A Winter's Tale, who becomes a statue at the end. And the trick that Frankie had was that she was able to make real tears trickle down her face every night of her performance. And in fact, her performance was so fantastic that they had commemorative music boxes made of the statue whirling around to music. Although, as it turns out, this was another famous statue that she played. I believe the Statue of Liberty that was done as the music box. So it's a big deal that she was a statue because Frankie is now paralyzed and can't move. Meanwhile, T-Bell is not sitting around waiting for magic things to happen. She's actually out working the claim up in the hills trying to find gold. So as the play starts, basically T-Bell pretty quickly bursts in to find out, much to her surprise, about Frankie's illness. And also that, well, May basically has made a pretty big bet about Frankie being able to dance in 2 days, and their ability to leave Skegway is entirely dependent on Frankie's ability to basically do this and win this bet. Oh gosh, I don't really know where to start about this play, but at the very beginning, I simply lost my ability within a few minutes to believe anything that was going on, which is unfortunate because it rarely happens to me that my knowledge of history or culture is enough for me to just declare something completely impossible from the very beginning. But I know a couple of things about the times in Alaska. One of the things that I know is that women actually didn't run claims, and that T-Bell's entire reason for being away and showing up was just the biggest bit of malarkey I'd seen on a stage in ages. And while I could believe, I have to say, Frankie was very convincingly paralyzed, but what I found so unrealistic about her is that when she later sort of stands up and does the flashback scenes, she talks in the broadest American accent. And while actors here are certainly known these days for their wonderful mimicry of accents from all around England and maybe from around the world, an Irish actress who emigrated to America to perform Shakespeare would certainly not have talked like she was a member of the Brady Bunch. And Frankie and T-Bell both spoke modern American idiom and rhythm all the way through, and I found that it very much put me off. While meanwhile, May was sitting there talking in the thickest Irish accent imaginable. And I was just sitting there watching a piece of fantasy that somebody had made up out of their head and decided to pretend that it could ever possibly be a real play. And I could tell you more about it. But to be honest, sometimes I think I'm a little bit mean when I watch these plays, and that maybe I'm just too hateful. Paul, John, I'd love to hear your opinions on it.
Well, I thought the interesting thing about the piece was, I thought the set, it looked lovely. Felt like you wanted to move to Alaska almost with its very nice design about it. I guess I'm a bit the same as you, Web Cowgirl, because while it was, I think it's a very interesting period, and there's no doubt a very good story about the role of women in the Alaskan gold rush period to be told, but you don't get a sense in this piece of how desperate this situation must have been in a town that is just dying and people are leaving in droves already. There's these three women, one of who's had a stroke and needs to be cared for, and you don't get that sense of desperation either in how inhospitable the land was, because just reading up on it, very few women went there because those that did wouldn't end up living very long. And you don't get that sense too about how foreign they must have been in this town. And one of the things that I thought with Frankie, okay, she was a dancer, but surely she would have been also a sex worker to actually make her way in this town. But none of that's kind of explored so well. So I was a bit disappointed by the piece. And I think had it have actually gone into some of that, it might have made for a much more interesting show. But having said that, it was acted well. I wasn't so bothered by the the varying accents, and it was lovely to look at. But yeah, it was probably overall not entirely believable. What do you think, John?
Dum da dum 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 dum. I'm afraid all the way through, all I could hear was Huckleberry Hound singing that damn song, because there they are in a cavern, in a canyon, excavating for a mine. And what are these women doing? And where have all their menfolk gone? I mean, you can understand, given their personalities, why the menfolk might have deserted them. But as Webcow Girl points out, women didn't go prospecting either in the California Gold Rush, which is the subject of Clementine, or in the Alaskan Gold Rush, which is the subject of In Skagway. There were other things going round in my head. Here you have a once famous, once enormously popular actress marooned in an inhospitable room in a wheelchair. Oh, but it's in Alaska, so suddenly this is whatever happened to baby Sarah Palin. I really could not treat this thing seriously, because I could not engage with the narrative and the framework within which it's set. And talking of the framework within which it's set, I am absolutely sure that set is recycled. I have seen those planks somewhere else. And maybe it's just a popular trope in stage design to use broken up pallets for indicating log cabins or wooden shacks in the wilderness.
Can I say something nasty about the set? It's going to get really cold, and they have got spaces 3 inches wide between every one of those planks. And my thought is, they don't have to wait till winter to freeze to death, because they're already going to be frozen to death.
Maybe they had some terrific insulation that we didn't quite see.
And apart from that, you can see Russia through those slats.
Okay, John, the only thing that I really enjoyed about In Skagway was the really cool light show behind the slats that was taking place when May's tiny mind was becoming smaller.
Because it was very effectively lit, actually, to sort of move between those two scenes. It was quite nicely done, I thought.
Yeah, and I did actually get into the play when I'd basically given up on there ever being anything that I cared about. And then that nasty piece of work, Nellie the pig, broke into the cabin. So there you've got a paralyzed woman.
Dear listener, there isn't an actual pig. She just means one of the women in the cast.
And that was her name, anyway.
Who has a rather tough personality.
Yeah, who also seemed...
people be going now expecting Babe or Betty Blue Eyes. I mean, it's not that kind of a pig.
No,
yeah, it makes it sound more exciting, rather like, you know, Sylvia or the goat, which it turns out it's actually the same thing. But I actually got really into the scene where Nellie broke into the cabin looking for some money. And there was her former best friend, now helpless, sitting in there. And I just felt like absolutely anything could happen. And that scene, for all of its improbability, I mean, frankly, it could have been happening in a council flat in Glasgow with someone busting in to get some drug money into the home of someone who was now paralyzed. And I think it would have played just as well. In fact, it would have made a lot more sense. But that scene, I think, really got like the helplessness that people have when they have a stroke. And then just the kind of random viciousness that people can have and how people interact with people in that situation. I think it's really a shame that Karen Ardiff didn't take her own life experiences and try to use them to make a better play. Because for all that In Skagway won some awards, I just think it's a very, very poor play that deserves to die a death and never be seen again.
Do we think it's meant to be metaphorical? Do we think it's meant to have some universal truth about how people can't move on from a situation? Because otherwise, I agree with Web Cowgirl that, you know, this would be just as good if it were an Andrea Arnold thing like Red Road. You know, people were stuck in a tower block in Glasgow rather than stuck in a mining town in Alaska. But I do want to say that I thought the acting was extremely good. And some of the scripting is as well. It's just that you don't care about the characters or where they're going or why they are in conflict. So that's a failure of the play. But it's not a failure of the performances. And I thought particularly as May, Geraldine Alexander, for all she reminds me of Julie Andrews, and I can't take her seriously sometimes because of the striking resemblance, I thought was really pretty well cast and was performing at at her peak in that. And I also liked the pig. I liked Natasha Starkey as Nellie. I thought, she had a quality about her that wasn't just, your typical two-dimensional bar girl or saloon girl, that she had a little bit more about her, a bit more layering than that. And I quite like both the character and the performance. But I like all of us, really, I just didn't care about the play.
Yes, and I think, John, what you're saying there, too, is about, I think there is this theme about the choice between the future and keep chasing dreams of the past, both with the fame and the gold rush has run out. I think there's obviously a heavy metaphor there. And, again, the acting is wonderful in it, but I think the whole premise of the play is a bit hard to actually accept, which probably makes it less enjoyable than it could have been.
Yeah, and it's a real pity. I do agree with you. The acting was good.
Yeah, and it's billed as a gritty all-female Irish Western as well.
We're now going to talk about Oh, What a Lovely War at the Theatre Royal Stratford East. This play is directed by Terry Johnson and is, to a certain extent, a recreation of an original done by Joan Littlewood 51 years ago in 1963, which combined stories from the First World War, research done by her theatre workshop, and songs from the period in a sort of a musical extravaganza. John, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
I had really high hopes about What a Lovely War. I'd applied for my press tickets a year before the performance because Theatre Royal Stratford East had been trailing it as an anniversary production, not just, as you say, of the centenary of the First World War, but also a sort of 50-ish anniversary of Joan Littlewood's landmark production, which I had studied as a drama student and knew was the piece that kind of gave a popular face to stage satire and shifted satire on a pace, a political satire at any rate. And I think, there are seeds in Oh, What a Lovely War of the way in which a lot of modern TV comedy is structured and how it took license to poke fun at politicians and warmongers and the whole act of war. Yes, you're right. I agree with you, Tim, that it is a loving recreation. And if I've got an early criticism about it, it's that it's a too affectionate, too camply sentimental revival. As you might expect from Terry Johnson, who has, an affection for all these sorts of things. And I think perhaps the line he took is a bit misguided. I think what would serve Oh, What a Lovely War better is if it were represented more in the perspective of the broader scope of what's happened in terms of warmongering and the wars that have been waged since 1918. But it's done in the same bumptious style as the original. There's a Pierrot company, a sort of seaside end of the pier players, who are acting out all the scenes. And there's a lot of gleeful stereotyping of every possible flavour of Johnny Foreigner. And there are some lovely cameos. Caroline Quentin, I thought, was surprisingly good, really. She plays the... Everyone will remember Maggie Smith in the movie, the recruiting soubrette, the woman who wants to go out every night with a soldier. But later, quite poignantly, she's the voice of the piece as a very articulate pacifist. And as I think she's very much better than you might expect from her television work or the infuriating Sharps and You fitted bedroom commercials that seem to be paying her rent at the moment. I also thought some of the younger men in the cast, there's a guy called Tom Lorcan, who I thought was quite effective in most of his roles. And there was an understudy the night I went to see it, a young man called Marcus Ellard, who was also extremely good and very sweet. But I think this thing needs more than a wallow in the foamy tub of nostalgia to bring a 51-year-old script to life. The first half, the exposition and the scene setting and the establishment of the politics leading up to Archduke Ferdinand's assassination in Serbia and how the powers take sides, Russia, Austro-Hungary, Britain, France, Germany. Britain, France, take their roles it's a little bit tedious, and you can sense the audience getting a bit tired of it. And in fact, they don't really relax until they get to the sort of comfortingly familiar from Blackadder stuff in the trenches, where we're all familiar with dramas like Journey's End and so on, and the life of the soldier on the Western Front. this is handled very well in the production. There's a piece at the end of the first half which is recreating the moment during the Christmas Day ceasefire, where the Germans and the British soldiers meet in no man's land and just exchange simple gifts and greetings. And it's very tender and very affecting. And there were lots of people who went to the bar in the interval wiping their eyes or blowing their noses. And it really was very well done. After the interval, it sort of turns into a numbers game, really. And there's a dot matrix scoreboard strung from the back of the auditorium. Heaven knows why they did that as an electronic, anachronistic thing. In the original production, they do it on a cricket scoreboard, don't they? They hang the numbers on hooks, all the cast do. But what it's doing is charting the casualties every time General Haig sticks to his blindly repetitive strategy of sending British soldiers armed only with Enfield rifles and bayonets over the top, over the barbed wire, into the machine gun fire of the Germans, because they had that technology when we didn't. During this, you get most of the company change parts every 5 minutes, but most of the second half, Ian Bartholomew plays General then Field Marshal Haig, and it's, I think that's pretty strong stuff. I think it's a very good characterization, and he shows some sides of the character that I hadn't realized were part of Haig's personality, that he was a bit of a religious fanatic, and that also he was somewhat politically ambitious and hoping for the patronage and the influence of the king, and really not shown in this piece as a very nice person. But it's done very well. You reach the end and there's a little brief curtain speech about the continued futility of war. But there's a great scene before that where the American profiteers who are supplying the war effort with armaments and equipment and food and things like that, who have kind of got together and manipulated the newspapers, the governments and popular opinion to keep the war going because it's lucrative for them. And that, for me, was really quite scary and made me think that possibly that's something that they're still doing 100 years later. So as I say, it is moving, and you may well be touched by it, but I do think it needs just a little bit more framing than this production gave it. But I can say you should go and see it. It's sold out for the entire run. There are some day seats and returns available, and I believe that Stratford are looking at ways of trying to schedule some more performances, possibly extra matinees, because they can't extend the run. But whether they'll be able to do that whilst Caroline Quentin is rehearsing Relative Values, I don't really know.
I certainly enjoyed myself. But I also, you know, there are one or two things I question. One of the things they do with the casualty figures is they somewhat conflate things. So sometimes you're getting casualties and sometimes you're getting deaths. You're sometimes getting things like, I mean, we did have machine guns, we didn't have any anywhere as near as many as the Germans did, because they suddenly put up a statistic about how long a machine gun team would survive, which would be a bit odd if it was the Germans in that case, because the, you know, sort of about 3 minutes. But yeah, the whole idea of the waste of life. I mean, I did some reading after seeing this, and you see things like, I think it was the Battle of the Marne, which is the battle that basically stopped the German advance into France, stopped them getting to Paris, and basically formed the trench lines that lasted for another 4 years. That was, I think it was over 1 million people on each side in that battle. I mean, it was just a tremendously large number of people taking part, which is part of why the deaths are so huge. If you consider that, actually, you know, the death rates, even when you're doing well, and a lot of the revisionist people are talking about, you know, how the last 100 days of the war, the British actually started winning, and it really was the British who were winning. We were capturing more Germans than the French were. The French were in charge of much longer parts of the front than we were, and we just were really successful. And a lot of the sort of revisionist historians who want to say it wasn't as bad as all that are happy to point that out. I mean, I think Dan Snow pointed out that the average soldier it lived at the trenches, in the trenches for 10 days out of every month, and would only be at the actual front for 3 days out of every month. So really? It wasn't quite as bad as, you know, it wasn't quite the Blackadder thing where they appear to be permanently living in the front. But of course, if you've ever read your Robert Graves and Goodbye to All That, you know that if you're at the front, if you're taking part in a big push, you pray that you're in the third company. You pray you're in the fourth company, which is the reserve company, because the others will just get annihilated. You take a battalion, it's got four companies, they send one over the top, the second one over the top, the second guys over the top don't quite realise what's happened to the first guys, but the third company that has to go over the top, they know exactly what's happened to the first two companies. And it's a rather terrifying idea of what you need to do. One thing that slightly bothered me, I mean, other than, as I said, it's something that has been pointed out in other reviews. I mean, it is a little bit reverential. It is a little bit an attempt to recreate what they had before at Stratford East, I think, and rather than taking on something really new and doing something, you know, doing something fairly radical with it. I mean, doing something that, because I kept remembering that the thing I know most is the film, and I kind of missed, you know, I quite kind of like the way they did the film, and I think they did the film better than this, although it was good to see the sort of the old Pierrot costumes. But I don't think people quite understand, you know, about the whole Pierrot thing, which was still something that I think a lot of people would have recognized when they saw it in 1963. That's, but they wouldn't have done now.
I have to interject that my very very first appearance on any stage was in a little bit of audience participation in a Pierrot show in Blackpool when I was four. So yes, it would have been enormously familiar to theatregoers in the 50s and 60s as a typical kind of seaside entertainment that we actually went to.
And also you have things like the Good Companions. I kept trying to, if somebody had come up to mention, talk to me, because they do a bit of mingling in the audience, I would have mentioned the Good Companions, which is J.B. Priestley. It was a J.B. Priestley play, and it's filmed with John Gielgud, an early John Gielgud role, which is rather odd when you see it. One of the problems I had with this is that like Blackadder, it seems to finish in 1917. It doesn't really sort of... One of the things that I think, and you get with a lot of, again, back to the revisionist historians, say, is they point out that we actually won the war, that the Britain actually, you know, Britain and France and America, they actually won the war. They, you know, they really did crush Germany. And because this play wants to say how bad it was in the trenches, and how terrible it was, and what a waste of life it was, the one thing they don't want is actually to have that sense of victory at the end. That sense of, you know, they really just want to say, oh no, they all got tired of fighting. They went down to what Haig says about, you know, there will be a thousand more men, there will be a thousand more soldiers in Britain than are in Germany, and then so Britain will win the war.
He says that at the end of the last battle, there'll be 5,000 on the German side and 10,000 on the British side, so we will have won.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, I mean, is possibly another one like Lions Led by Donkeys, and another quote, yes, which is possibly not true. So yeah, they.
But one of the boasts of the play is that everything you see on stage was said, spoken, or done during the First World War. It's supposed to be only made up of actual quotations, but I agree with you that, you know, contemporary historians have probably taken a slightly jaundiced view about how accurate some of those quotations were.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly the Lions Led by Donkeys was apparently made up by Alan Clark in his book Donkeys, I think it was called, or Lions, sorry, and he wrote about it, and he is the earliest source for Lions Led by Donkeys, which is and that was in just before this play opened, really. It was a book published the same year and possibly helped to inspire them doing it when they did it. So, I mean, I enjoyed a lot of it. I don't usually enjoy musicals, but I did enjoy a lot of it. There's some very nice performances. I mean, as you say, Caroline Quentin, I quite liked Alice Bailey-Johnson as well. She sings about a very odd song about a Belgian victory, which wasn't exactly a Belgian victory, but by the time it was actually written, looking up again, It was sort of what Belgium put the kibosh on the Khyber, Kaiser,
yeah.
And it was actually written after Belgium had surrendered. It was about the siege of Liège, which lasted sort of 10 days when it was supposed to only last two. Mm. So it was a very brave bit of Belgian fighting, but it was, you know, it wasn't exactly a victory, which is what the song is all about. And again, something we've seen with something we talked about earlier today in plays done by the company at Southwark Playhouse, what the women did. Oh, What a Lovely War only really looks at sort of the jingoism to show you how idiotic the jingoism was. They don't deal with everything that people were saying about the war, the way that there was a sort of an understanding and a sort of stoic just getting on with it about a lot of what people did. They, you know, it wasn't that they were glorying in the war, and it wasn't that they were absolutely miserable and dead set against it. It was a sort of something in between where they just said, well, it's happening and we can't do anything to stop it, so we might as well make the best of it. And that's probably the more accurate way of doing things. But I think this glories in the idea that everybody was wildly jingoistic about it, and I don't think they entirely were. But I mean, it was fascinating to see it. It's fascinating to see it, and as you say, it's all been sold out for ages. I noticed that they're going to do Things Ain't What They Used to Be, which is a similar sort of devised piece. Although I think Lionel Bard had a lot more to do with the musical direction of that, and they're going to do that in May and June. That might be an interesting thing to revisit.
Oh dear. I was in Things Ain't What They Used to Be in an amateur production that Lionel Bart actually came to, pissed out of his brain. It was not the best night of my life, but I'll tell the listeners more about it when we go and see this production.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Ozette Unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook. On the web, we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.